The Narcolepsy Nerd Alert series invites listeners to dive deeper into specific topics relevant to living with narcolepsy. For more on this topic, please check out our corresponding toolkit, available for free on our website to download, print, and share. The link to the toolkit and other Narcolepsy Nerd Alert topics is in the show notes, or you can go to project-sleep.com. Welcome to Project Sleep's podcast. Project Sleep is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to raising awareness and advocating for sleep health, sleep equity, and sleep disorders. I'm your host, Julie Flygar. We're so glad you're here as we work together towards making sleep cool. On this podcast, all guests express their own opinions. While medical diagnoses and treatment options are discussed for educational purposes, this information should not be taken as medical advice. Each person's experience is so unique, which is why it's so important to always consult your own medical team when making decisions about your own health. If you haven't done so yet, please hit the subscribe button so you never miss a Project Sleep podcast episode. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave us a rating or review wherever you listen so that we can reach more listeners and raise more awareness. Hello, welcome to our broadcast today. We are so excited today to talk to you about how to talk to your doctor about sleep issues. Such an important question and conversation. So really excited today to have some special guests with us. And I think I'll go ahead and let them introduce themselves and share a little bit about their background and why they are with us today. So Dr. Roland, you want to go ahead and go first?
Yeah, so Josh Roland, I'm a board certified sleep medicine physician, the chief medical director of SANUSOM, which focuses on CPAP adherence, also advisor for Dream and 30 Madison on their sleep endeavors. Long history in sleep medicine, and this topic is especially important to me. I was also trained as a family medicine physician, so kind of saw that side of things as well. So I'm happy to be here and hopefully provide some context with that. So thank you, Julie.
Yeah, and Josh is also the author of this book, I Am Getting a Sleep Study, which I have here without a signature. I can't wait to get his signature on the book. But tell us why you wrote the book.
So just a book to walk through for parents and kids, how to get what the process is for a sleep study. I remember when I was young, I got my tonsils out and we had a book that just like walked through the process, made it simpler, less scary. So there was really not a lot I saw in terms of that for sleep. Sleep studies can be very confusing, very scary if you're not sure what you're getting into. So just kind of a very brief kind of overview of what happens during a sleep study to help kids. And then there's tips for parents as well to help out a little bit with the process.
I think this could help adults too. It's kind of scary as an adult.
Good. Yeah. You know, it's amazing how many like parents actually help them out. They said, you know, just as much as the kids. So hopefully, you know, something useful out there, people getting sleep studies.
Thank you. And Kristen, introduce yourself.
Hi. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me here. My name is Kristen Cassio. I am a clinical social worker. I live in Boston. But I'm here today for the patient perspective because about 4 years ago, I was diagnosed finally with obstructive sleep apnea. I've been using a CPAP ever since. And I always joke I'm sort of emotionally attached to my CPAP now because I've had such a great response to it. But before I made it to that point, I had from my teenage years, 15 plus years of daytime sleepiness and other symptoms that I did not know were sleep apnea. So I'm really happy to be here and for all the work that Project Sleep does.
Thank you, Kristen. And Lauren, our programs manager, she runs our Rising Voices program. But Lauren, you want to share especially why you are a special guest today on today's broadcast?
So after working with Project Sleep for almost 4 years now, I was just finally diagnosed with sleep apnea 2 weeks ago. So I'm here today to also talk about my perspective as a patient going through the whole process. And like Kristen, I was probably living with symptoms for at least 20 years and not really realizing it. Until I started working for Project Sleep, and it still took me a long time to realize that might be what I was dealing with. And so here we are, and I'm looking forward to starting treatment, kind of interested to see what'll happen and just along for the ride.
Awesome. And thank you for sharing both your personal story and all you do to organize us professionally and bringing both together. We hope that we don't make sleep disorders contagious or something over here. I think I'm glad that we could help empower you with information to, you know, get help, but it still was a long process. So
for sure.
I think just to kind of start the conversation, it's somewhat important to kind of understand what symptoms might be part of a sleep disorder diagnosis. And, you know, we don't always connect these things to sleep issues, especially because I think a lot of sleep issues really come out during the daytime. And that's not something that I think is discussed nearly enough, that having a sleep disorder doesn't mean that you just have an experience that's bad at night, but also could be during the day. So we just have a long list here of some different things. And let's see. I mean, I know from my experience, like the first thing that really stuck out to me was not being able to drive in the morning after a full night's sleep and not remembering the end of that 15-minute drive. And that seemed striking. Then when I look back, I realized that like my inability to get through law school studies, you know, I was like reading the same text over and over again and not remembering what I was reading. But I really didn't think of that as a sleep issue. I thought I'd like somehow lost my willpower. So I think it's just really good to just really understand all these different things could be a symptom of a different sleep disorder. Does anyone have anything to add here?
I must say, Julie, so you kind of nailed it, where some of the symptoms are very obvious, you know, waking up at night or trouble falling asleep, but there's a wide range of symptoms that are not obvious that are related to sleep disorders, cognitive function, mood, you know, headaches in the morning, you know, different things, attention span, ADHD symptoms sometimes can be related to sleep disorders, even things, other health conditions that people don't think about, so difficult to control blood pressure, be a sign of sleep apnea. So it was very overt ones that we all kind of think about. And then there's a ton that, you know, we don't always put together until after the fact, potentially, you know, after the diagnosis or after someone suggests them. So it's important to be aware of the breadth of different symptoms that can be related to sleep issues.
Yeah.
I know for me, I think brain fog is the worst. And I was wondering, you know, do I have some kind of ADHD or something like that? Because if I don't write something down, I can't remember it. And it really kind of interferes with a lot of my functioning and it can be really embarrassing. And so, you know, I haven't started treatment yet, but I'm interested to see if that, you know, if that is alleviated. And you know, but again, thinking back like to my symptoms, like early days, I remember like Julie, like reading the same textbook material over and over and over and over and not being able to retain it. And I think that was maybe 20 years ago in college. So, you know, and then feeling like I have a band of pressure around my head, like all these weird things that I didn't put together as symptoms of a sleep disorder.
I can relate to that too. And I love what Julie said, that it's not what's happening when you're asleep, it's what's happening during the day. Because I thought for years and years, I can't have a sleep disorder. I sleep fine every night. I don't have any problems with my sleep, but I didn't know that I was waking up all throughout the night, not really getting consistent sleep. But some of the things that stood out for me that I wish I could have gone back in time, but I just accepted was part of my life, were the morning headaches. I had a headache almost every single morning, and I just did not know that that wasn't typical. And usually I was just running out the door to whatever next thing I had to do. And I'm sure we'll get to it later, but you know, the things you do to explain away the symptoms, I think that really took a hold of me for a long time. You know, the trouble staying awake during the day, it wasn't just because I was busy or I was in school or I was doing this, that, or the other thing. It was because I had a sleep disorder and I was busy doing all of these other things.
Kristen, can you remind me like what it was for you that was the turning point, you know, from thinking that something's just your personality or just that these other, you know, the headaches are just a thing? When was it when you were like, oh no, I think something's wrong?
Yeah, well, I had a lot of periods of time where I was like, oh no, I think something is wrong, but I still never thought it was a sleep disorder that was wrong. So I just sort of went in circles with doctors all the time trying to rule things out. Like we would check my mood, track your period, track like my sleeps, start waking up and going to sleep, which also didn't turn into more questions about my sleep, which I didn't, if I had known that at the time, I would have investigated a little bit further. But, you know, I had a lot of turning points where I got really frustrated. But the one that really, you know, stuck to me was I was working from home And every day at 5 p.m., I would feel like I had to walk right from the office over here across the hall to my bed and go back to sleep. And I was just so frustrated. And I was looking around me like, I'm not any more busy than anybody else right now. It was also during COVID. I don't have anything else really going on that other people don't. So why am I so much more tired than those people? And so I had armed with me, you know, the years and years and years of other things that had been ruled out. So I kind of pulled together my own little diary, I guess, a little like advocacy diary. And I tracked my own sleep, mood, things that I had going on during the day for weeks and brought that to my doctor and said, like, I think something else is going on here. And that's what really finally spurred the sleep study.
Wow. That's really interesting, especially during the pandemic, because I feel like, yeah, I mean, if you were just home, you didn't even have to drive. So just like less things to make excuses about.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. So thank you. I want to just mention here, Dr. Mark Patterson had mentioned, you know, a really great point about, you know, making sure to mention your sleep concerns to your doctor because they may fail to ask about it during the routine visits. And that's, thank you, Dr. Patterson. That's definitely why we're doing this because, you know, that's, we know that primary care doctors just generally don't receive much education on sleep. And so we're hoping that this is a power to a tool to empower people, you know, the patients to somewhat be educating their doctors and helping to take next steps. So yeah, that's what we're really hoping to do here. Unfortunately, because we'd love that the doctors are the advocates, that we'd love that they're the ones asking the questions, the right questions, and that we could just rely on them to do that work. But at this point, it seems that the patients have to be more proactive. So yeah, I think just providing really specific examples can be really helpful and how that impacts your daily life in really concrete ways. I think that's just something that I've noticed helps me even understand other people's experience. Like when Kristen just described about going across her house to her bed right after work at 5 p.m., like I could really visualize that. And that really helped me better understand how that was really playing out rather than just hearing the word like, oh, I'm tired every day. Like, I don't know what that looks like. So, and yeah, I mean, asking friends and loved ones, I've heard a lot of people say that, you know, they didn't realize something was wrong until they moved in with their fiance or something. And then their fiance is like, something's not, this isn't normal. And not that we're not, well, you know, we have our own experience and our own experience and our feelings are, and what we understand about ourselves is really important because a lot of this can be really invisible. But also, I think too, it can be really easy to kind of make excuses. Or I know for me, I repressed a lot. So, because I felt ashamed. So, you know, falling asleep in class or closing my eyes in class and then waking up and catching eyes with my professor, I felt a lot of shame around that. And I think I pushed it back in my own head because I didn't like that that was happening to me. And then it was interesting years later to find out from someone who'd taken a lot of classes with me that they were not surprised at all I'd had a narcolepsy diagnosis because they had watched me almost every day fall asleep in class. And I had no idea that they had seen that way. So what do you guys think about this?
Julie, I did not know until I went to college and had a couple of roommates that most people do not regularly take 6-hour naps. Like, I just thought that that was a thing that people did during the day. And so that really got me thinking at that time, if I regularly need to take a 6-hour nap, maybe something else is going on here. So just seeing the comparison between, you know, the other people your age sort of functioning at the same level as you with the same responsibilities, how they're getting through their days differently. I think you can really highlight the differences.
And those stories too can be helpful for, you know, when speaking with your provider, just the specifics that, you know, some of it is hard to differentiate what is pathological, what is not. You know, if a kid in their, you know, teenager or someone in their 20s comes and says they're tired, a lot of us were tired in that age, or a lot of people are tired in that age. If someone comes in and says, hey, I'm sleeping 6 hours, you know, taking these 6-hour naps, that quantifies it a little bit more and hopefully helps alert the provider that this is not, you know, abnormal behavior. Something more needs to be looked at there. So those specific stories can absolutely just help, you know, just kind of highlight what exactly you're experiencing and help, you know, help with those discussions with the provider.
Yeah. I mean, teens seem really scary. It's a scary time because often with the school start times being so early, that all students might be sleep deprived. And so how does a student with a sleep disorder almost stand out from a chronically sleep deprived group of teens. Yeah, I guess it's probably, I guess those additional things like, you know, having headaches or cataplexy or hypnagogic hallucinations, you know, that probably, I guess, would end up making someone stand out. Is that, would that be sort of what you'd be looking for?
Those would certainly be like red flags, but I mean, that's the part that gets really hard, is especially certain groups. And I think that group is one of the hardest, and that's unfortunately where a lot of these sleep disorders present in, you know, that kind of age group. But, you know, we have a delayed circadian rhythm, we have early school or activities. Often all of us don't have the best sleep, you know, habits in that time, you know, in terms of what we're doing and being social and, you know, everything else, that it's a tough group. That, you know, it does just take some work to dig in, and it does take a provider that's thinking about sleep disorders when they're kind of looking at all these symptoms to hopefully, you know, get them in that direction and get the patient diagnosed. And, you know, it's unfortunate where a lot of people with sleep disorders are misdiagnosed, or I should say not fully diagnosed, or they might be diagnosed with depression or something else, you know, going on that does kind of make sense from a perspective, but it's not really capturing the entire picture of what's going on in terms of sleep pathology.
And I think this point too about asking friends and loved ones what they've noticed, I think sometimes the people close to you can maybe observe and understand you a little better when you're in denial or something about something that might be going on with yourself. Like for me, like my husband was concerned about me because he would say that I would kind of wake up like with a gasping noise. And that was a big red flag. And that was actually one of the things that helped me like continue pushing for a diagnosis. Cause like, even though my first two sleep studies were inconclusive, I was like, no, this is happening, you know? So having that information was super helpful. And then also just the way that it was affecting my family also motivated me, because I remember my, at the time, 14-year-old, and I went to see this new Studio Ghibli movie. It was like the first movie they'd released in a long time. We're big fans. We were super excited. And, you know, we get to the movie theater, but like I fell asleep 2/3 of the way through the movie and like missed all but the very end of the movie. And it was so crushing because it was something we'd been so excited about to do together. And then it just looked like I wasn't into it. And so, you know, my kid is noticing that too. And so that's a bit of like motivation and also information that can be helpful, I think, to take to your doctor, is like how it's affecting you in your daily life. And then also what other people are noticing.
Yeah. And sometimes I think even bringing like, you know, a loved one with you to an appointment, if that's possible, can be helpful. I don't know. Sometimes I feel like, I don't know. I know we have a really wonderful doctor with us. I don't want to, you know, put down doctors, but you know, that sometimes like almost like hearing from not the patient can be helpful, like the loved one. I don't know. Do you feel that way?
Absolutely. I think it's extremely helpful to get the bed partner history with anything sleep related. Obviously, we only have a limited idea of ourselves, what's happening during sleep. So having that perspective is really crucial. You know, really the amount of patients that come into clinic really referred by their significant other or family member is enormous, where, you know, I'll ask the patient, why did they, you know, what brought them in the sleep clinic? So many times you hear the answer of, you know, my bed partner, my family member, I was just concerned that I do XYZ in my sleep. And, you know, they weren't even aware of it. They end up having severe sleep apnea or some other condition. And having that context, having that perspective and that history from somebody witnessing these behaviors firsthand, you know, it's huge. We ask a lot of questions, hopefully to get at the bottom of a sleep diagnosis, but we're really not seeing what's happening in the bedroom. We do sleep studies, which give us a lot of really great information of what's happening during sleep, but it's not going to capture, you know, everything that's always happening at home. So that history is really important. I think most, if not all, sleep doctors really appreciate getting that input if possible.
So I think this is an important topic to address because of the language, you know, that we use and how we talk about sleep and sleep issues. I think before I entered this, you know, I guess field or community, I think I would have thought as the word like fatigue or tired kind of interchangeably. And now I think we try to point out that these words might mean sort of different things. And so, you know, sleepiness is We see more as the desire to fall asleep, and almost like that if you had the opportunity to sleep, that you actually would fall asleep. And that fatigue is more a lack of both physical and emotional energy and motivation, but sort of that if you did lay down, you might not actually fall asleep. You'd stay awake, but without energy. And so it's interesting. I did just have a friend here from the Netherlands who is a neurologist and a sleep specialist. And she said that in the Netherlands, tiredness is, you know, I think that, I mean, I guess it says here. So I thought being tired is more like sleepy, but it says here that tired is more like fatigue. So maybe I got it wrong, but maybe tired is a confusing word and maybe somewhere in the middle between these things. But, and then of course, a depression, because some people get diagnosed with depression. So that depression is more persistent feeling of sadness, disappointment, and hopelessness, along with other emotional, mental, and physical changes that interfere with daily activities. And I think, you know, sleep issues can also cause depression and anxiety, but also it can go the other way too, that I imagine that depression and anxiety can lead to sleep issues. So, but that also, I think with depression would be a case that if someone like laid down on a bed, they wouldn't necessarily fall asleep. Am I getting the right gist there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's such an overlap in these kind of these symptoms, but they are definitely distinct as well. And sometimes very important to make these distinctions to get the diagnosis. You mentioned sleepiness is just the propensity to actually sleep versus fatigue, you know, lack of energy. And then depression, it's really a very common psychiatric, psychological, you know, medical condition there, mental health condition. And then a lot of a bi-directional relationship between mental health and depression and sleep, as you mentioned, that not sleeping well can cause depression, but also being depressed can cause sleep issues. So these are all important, you know, differentiations to make, but a lot of overlap. It can be challenging even for physicians to kind of tease this apart and look at these as different components.
I think even now, I still mislabel how I'm feeling because to me, sleepiness is really what I was going through all these years, but that didn't feel like a proper word. It didn't feel like enough to describe what was going on. So I would always say, I don't have any energy or I'm so fatigued. But then that does take you around a lot of diagnoses, you know, thyroid issues, mental health issues, everything. There's so many things that can cause low energy, just being really busy. So I don't fault any doctor for taking me down that line. They have really hard jobs, I think, primary care doctors especially, because there's so many things that can be going on. But I look back, like I wish I had known to use the term sleepiness, because I think that would have taken me down a different path a little bit earlier. And there was a very important like tipping point before my real tipping point that I was just thinking back the other day. Even when I went in, you know, with my little log that I had come up with myself about how much I was struggling, my doctor at the time, it was an endocrinologist because I do also get treated for my thyroid. And she said to me, this is 100% not your thyroid, but I'm not really sure what else it might be. And I think we might diagnose you with chronic fatigue syndrome, and we can't really do anything if that's what you have, but let's just get you a sleep study. So I was like right on the tipping point there. And so I think language makes such a big difference. And that's why it's so important that, you know, we're getting this out there so people can come in a little bit more informed.
Yeah, I remember on our, we had a broadcast about brain fog and we talked about how the fact that there's these different stages of sleep, but that wakefulness, when we talk even about wakefulness, we pretend it's all one thing and it's really not. You know, it's not like you're just 100% wakeful, at least not as a person with, you know, a sleep disorder. So I don't know if that's kind of a different, but, you know, having your eyes open, but that your brain is not there with you, or that the consciousness in itself is not a perfect, it's not always like you're just perfectly 100% present, able to remember all that. I don't know if that's another, you know, sort of like way into this conversation about how it's just so much more complex and what it means to be awake versus asleep and the gray areas in between. But I agree with you, Kristen, like no energy, like that's how I feel all the time.
Yeah.
You know? That's a great description. It's like, I have nothing left. Like there's nothing left in my tank. I need to leave like right now. But, you know, I guess I just really like kind of helping to distinguish for people like, well, if you laid down, would you actually fall asleep? You know, I think that's an important question to at least tease out to some extent whether it's some sort of like sleepiness versus fatigue?
You know, fatigue is a very, very common concern in primary care, and it can be so many, you know, so many different things can cause or contribute to fatigue. Often it's multifactorial where there's a few different things going into it. And so some of the issue is that, you know, I think most doctors really want to help, but they help with the things that they know how to deal with, right? So primary care doctor, if you come in complaining of sleepiness, fatigue kind of picture, they're going to order lab work. They're going to look at, you know, iron, thyroid, metabolic panel, assess your mood potentially, and kind of do the things that they know well. And you know, they might not be thinking about your fatigue is really sleepiness and that you might have a sleep disorder. So again, I think a very important distinction to help, you know, really work together with your physician to kind of coming to if that's what you're going through.
I would just say, like, I feel like so lucky that when I did start to pursue a diagnosis, I had the language because I worked at Project Sleep to ask for a sleep study, because I would have just described it as fatigue. And I was describing it as fatigue for years. And my blood work was always normal. I just was accepting, well, this is just how I am. You know, maybe I'm depressed. I took medication for depression. It never really changed anything. But then once I started kind of putting the pieces together, I just straight up asked for a sleep study. And I have a wonderful nurse practitioner who, you know, listens to me and is extremely caring and open. And so he went ahead and just referred me for one right away. And that was still took a year and a half to get the diagnosis, but I was able to start that process without continuing on the treadmill of testing and not getting any answers.
Some of the worst thing that I hear is often that maybe they go through a few tests like thyroid and iron. And then when a doctor isn't sure what to do next, I've heard things like, well, you're a teacher, so, or you're a mother. So, and that's really what worries me is that, like, how can sleep become one of those next tools? You know, once they've gone through those initial general items in the toolbox, how do we get sleep in that toolbox? So it's not going back to, it's just your character or you're too busy.
Mm-hmm. Your lifestyle.
Many people get diagnosed with depression is that's kind of the, where it stops then is the primary, you know, the physician will say, oh, you have depression. And many people with sleep disorders first went through that kind of round of treatment, you know, where they thought they had depression. And again, that might be a part of, you know, the constellation of their symptoms that might've been beneficial treatment, as you mentioned, because the bidirectional relationship between sleep and depression, but you know, it's very often there's something more going on with sleep disorders. So it'll just be a challenge to navigate. And particularly if you went through all those tests and everything was, you know, fine and you came back and they told you that it's just you or, you know, it's your mood or whatever, you know, it can be frustrating.
Which I guess in terms of the depression piece, I'll just jump in here for a lot of the advocacy work that you're doing is focused on primary care, well, all healthcare providers, but I am a clinical social worker and you learn when you're like treating or assessing for depression, just to ask about somebody's sleep, but we didn't learn anything about sleep disorders. You just learn like, how is your sleep basically? So maybe that's an area too that needs to be expanded on in our clinical training programs. If I knew then what I know now, I think things would have been a lot different.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And a lot of the work we want to try to do to like partner with the mental health space too, and make sure that they can consider sleep disorders as a resource in certain cases. So,
are you facing sleep issues or a sleep disorder? Project Sleep is now excited to have the Sleep Helpline, a nonprofit-led free national helpline providing personalized support and resources. You can reach out today to speak with a compassionate resource specialist who will listen and help provide accurate sleep disorders information, resources to help navigate daily living and the healthcare landscape, and connect you with a certified sleep center and patient support organizations. Contact the Sleep Helpline at 1-800-819-2043 or by filling out a form on our website at project-sleep.com.
So there are some things that you can, you know, questionnaires that you can take at home. Josh, I don't know how you feel about people kind of filling out stuff in advance, or if you'd rather they just kind of come in. I don't think I did anything in advance, but I think, you know, these are some of the things you can access yourself. And the sleep disorders symptom checklist is a newer tool, 25 questions that that screens for 13 different sleep disorders. So, you know, Project Sleep is really proud to try to promote that as a good, really quick way to assess for, you know, a wide variety of sleep disorders. I mean, it's not a diagnosis by any means. It's just a survey or to just give you a sense. But I think it's just important to know that these tools are out there so that people can sort of be more empowered with some information.
So, you know, I think it's never a bad idea to look at symptoms and kind of get a sense of things, you know, particularly if you're not getting the answers that, you know, you kind of think are relevant with your provider. I would say, you know, all these tools are really helpful in a certain context, and a lot of it's having the right population that you're applying them to. So it can sometimes be a little misleading, you know, if you're doing them on your own. A lot of them were not designed or validated to necessarily do on their own, and it might be designed in a specific population. StopBang, for example, really great screening tool, or, you know, pretty good screening tool that we use very often or recommend for primary care or other doctors to use to assess for sleep apnea. Really was a tool that was validated for a pre-surgical population to assess risk for sleep apnea prior to surgery. So, you know, that looks a little different than kind of the overall just population that might have sleep apnea. In some studies out recently that the StopBang maybe doesn't account for certain genetic differences and, you know, a couple other things. So I think it's never bad to look at these and help kind of get a little bit of idea of, you know, what's going on and maybe even fill them out. But really they are meant for a certain population. So ideally, you know, you have a trained sleep physician or trained provider that can help you kind of navigate these tools a little bit.
Yeah, I just think they're kind of important to mention because what's the real world, I think, is happening is that, you know, people might have a sleep issue and they're more drawn towards consumer technologies to think that they're going to improve their sleep by tracking their sleep. I don't think we actually included anything about tracking here. And I think, Kristen, you said part of your story was really tracking your sleep at different points in your journey. But, you know, if you are thinking that there could be something wrong, that going beyond just having like, how would you feel if someone brought in like Fitbit data to say that they think something is wrong?
I love it personally, because anything is more data. You know, in the past, they really weren't validated and were kind of crude. They're getting better and better in terms of a lot of the, you know, the remote, you know, consumer data sources that are coming in. Still, you got to take it with a grain of salt, but at least it's providing some kind of context and some additional data. And I like it too, that it shows the patient is engaged. It's a way to kind of engage and talk about sleep. So sometimes it can be a helpful step to, you know, start the conversations, and it shows that they're caring about their sleep. So I don't know if all sleep doctors feel the same way, but I love seeing everyone's data. And, you know, sometimes you take it with a grain of salt, and it's has its, you know, maybe a narrow benefit there in terms of looking at things, but it does provide some context. And again, the technology is getting better and better over the years, that I think there's more and more opportunity for those to help us make decisions.
I think for me, the only screening tool that I'm actually familiar with here is the Epworth Sleepiness Scale, but it actually, like, I felt so relieved when I took it, because again, it was a lot of things that I never really gave a second thought to, because it asks you to rate how likely you are to fall asleep in certain situations. And it was like right after you had a meal, you know, opening up to read a book. I still struggle to stay awake reading a book, sitting, you know, and watching TV. And I was like, top on all of them. So it was kind of validating, but pointing out again, things that you just kind of explained away for years.
I remember the first time I saw like a question about cataplexy at the sleep center I went to. And the weird thing for me was it made me realize that there were other people out there that I was like, oh my God, this weird thing that's been happening to me for a few years is a checkbox. Like, mm-hmm. This means that other, so it was super validating for me in a way too, to just like really make sure, like this is real. So, you know, that was kind of a neat experience. It can be difficult for young women with a normal BMI to meet the StopBang criteria. Important to still push to see a sleep specialist if you have symptoms. So yeah, these are not by any means perfect tools, but yeah, I can give a little context.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually went and did the StopBang questionnaire today. in preparation for this conversation, and I scored low risk for sleep apnea, which is what I was just diagnosed with. So yeah, these aren't perfect by any means, and it's really important to see a doctor, but I agree that it's just validating, like, yeah, this is real. This is really happening to me. This happens to other people. And like, I'm not making it up. It's not just in my head.
And they all, you know, they all have a specific use that they're generally pretty good at, but and always good to look at to get an idea what else is out there to help sometimes maybe, you know, articulate what your symptoms are. Like you mentioned there, Kristen, that, you know, some of these symptoms maybe would have not brought up to a provider if you didn't see them on a questionnaire beforehand. But again, just keep in mind they are for a specific use. The Epworth, for example, great measurement of sleepiness, not really been shown to be that well validated between different patients, but it's a pretty good tool within one person. So if you put someone on treatment, you can really watch that the shift in it, hopefully in a positive direction. And that's been a little bit better validated. So inter-reliability versus intra are different for some of them, and just different ways they're used. But, you know, I still think great to look at to get a general sense of things and kind of start the conversations up. Clinical history is really the most important thing, which is why these discussions are so important, is really going over symptoms is, you know, really crucial and kind of figuring things out. Kind of along the lines of clinical history, we'll sometimes use sleep diaries or, you know, wearables or actigraphy, which help us kind of quantify things a little bit. Blood work can be helpful to look at certain things that are associated with certain sleep conditions or to rule things out that may look like a sleep disorder. Obviously, sleep studies play a big role in diagnostics. Both home and lab studies have their positives and negatives overall. I would say, you know, sleep study is very important, and then clinical history is extremely important for any sleep disorder.
This is really what the sleep doctor would do. These aren't things that your primary care doctor would necessarily do. I mean, I think maybe would a primary care be able to get you a home sleep study, possibly if they're considering sleep apnea, or?
It's a very good point. Primary care will probably not do a lot of these things. They can order testing, sleep testing. So, and it depends where you are living and kind of the, you know, the sleep support in terms of other providers and logistics on what people do and also training. Sometimes home tests or even in lab tests are ordered by primary care doctors. And then that'll start the diagnosis and send them into a sleep physician. Some people prefer it that way. It's like some sleep doctors would rather you have a study first before you kind of see them. I know myself and many others would like to just see the patient in the beginning, get the whole picture, then kind of figure out the test that we need. But absolutely. So primary care could lean in and start looking at blood work, obviously some of the history, and then even could order the sleep study. But they might also just defer to the sleep doctor as well.
Yeah. I mean, we always try to get people to a sleep specialist because we're just hoping that they'll have a better understanding of sleep disorders. Important to think about if you're at your primary care, how you like who you might see, because I remember being really confused, even though I'd found the words narcolepsy with cataplexy and was pretty sure that's what I'd been experiencing for years. I didn't know exactly who to see about it. And I didn't really understand some of these things that, like, I think one big thing I've learned is that sleep medicine is like a specialty, but it isn't your primary. Josh, can you explain it? It's not like your primary thing.
So this can be really confusing, you know, for patients, and can also cause some problems that maybe you saw somebody that you thought was really assessing for everything, such as narcolepsy, and maybe that wasn't a person who necessarily is trained in doing that. A lot of people are involved in sleep, which is great, you know, and kind of helping support different pathology and treatment. But not everyone is trained in the background to diagnose or manage, you know, everything in sleep medicine. So not to make it too back and too boring, but sleep medicine kind of started more in the psychiatric and neurology realm. So a lot of neurologists and psychiatrists were looking at sleep disorders many years ago. Then sleep apnea was appreciated. So pulmonologists started getting involved in sleep disorders because they knew how to use CPAP and other things that they used from the ICU that could be used to treat sleep apnea. And it really was everyone just kind of chipping in a little bit in their expertise. So a psychiatrist would look at insomnia and kind of manage that aspect. Neurologists would look at movement disorders and narcolepsy and central disorders of hypersomnolence. And then you had pulmonologists that were sort of managing the respiratory aspect of sleep medicine. And then it kind of merged into becoming its own field, where now you can actually get a certification, get a specialized in sleep medicine. Many of us, myself included, I solely practice sleep medicine. So there's still this range where you might have sleep providers that that's all they do, and they should be aware of, you know, really most disorders. Or you might still have some providers that are really doing a different specialty, but do also navigate and manage and see a lot of patients that have sleep disorders, and they'll try to treat those as well. But a wide range of really background in training at times. Dentists are now being appreciating sleep apnea at least a little bit more, which is good. ENTs involved, obviously sleep techs, respiratory therapists, behavioral sleep specialists all have their own perspective. And I think really a big takeaway point of this is if you're having sleep issues and you see you know, someone that navigates sleep, and it doesn't really result into like a diagnosis that, you know, feels right, it's never a bad idea to check with them, you know, another specialist that has a different perspective that, you know, might pick up on some things that that first, you know, sleep doctor didn't really.
Yeah, this is so confusing. So we do have a resource that we've created with our expert advisory board to kind of describe a little bit more about why each person's involved. Each kind of specialist might be involved in the sleep space. So yeah, but I think importantly, like the sleep specialists on the AASM's website or going to a accredited AASM's accredited sleep center can be like good starting points for people. And yeah, but then of course, not everyone might have the same level of knowledge or have the same number of patients with different conditions to really be the best support for you.
Yeah, I would say, Josh, to your point about, you know, seeking a second opinion, the first sleep doctor I saw was a neurologist and sleep medicine specialist and was telling me that, you know, my sleep architecture was normal and all this. And he didn't, you know, he didn't diagnose me with anything. He just kind of left it as, you know, and you know, after another year of experiencing symptoms and just being increasingly convinced that, yes, no, there is something wrong with my sleep, I went to a different practice. And I actually see the person who I'm seeing now is actually a nurse practitioner. And she diagnosed me with sleep apnea. And she gave me a really detailed breakdown of what was going on with my breathing. And so I don't know if it had to do with the first doctor's area of specialization in neurology or something like that. But definitely seek a second opinion if you don't feel like, you know, what's happening is right.
We have a really good question here. When you are looking for a new doctor, how do you know which of these to look for when you already have a diagnosis? And finding a new doctor, if you move, that will continue to care and doesn't want to start all over and take you off all of your meds to do. Yeah, there's a lot of different things. It can be difficult to find a new doctor and make sure that your care stays, you know, consistent. One thing that really struck me is that I guess, you know, if you're looking for a new doctor to see if they've ever, you know, I don't know, this is probably not possible unless you live in LA where I live, that you could see who's like actually doing research on a certain topic and who's really publishing on something would be someone that's just super in the know. I think clinical trials are another good way to get involved with top centers. Often if they're doing clinical trials, they're looking to be on the cutting edge and they're more likely to know all the different treatment options. Those are some ideas that come to mind for me, but anyone else have thoughts on that?
So certainly research, if they're doing research in that field, they are going to be very knowledgeable of that particular area of sleep medicine. I think in general, you know, if you go to someone who's board certified, it means they went to fellowship, they passed sleep boards, they should have a pretty good sense of, you know, most sleep disorders. You know, maybe not always, but that's a good starting point. Also, if you already have a diagnosis, and particularly if it's a, you know, maybe not one of the more common sleep disorders like sleep apnea, there's often foundations or kind of support groups or directories of people that are at least more interested in those. Like I know the Idiopathic Hypersomnia Foundation has a directory that they kind of vet doctors who have expertise or at least an interest in idiopathic hypersomnia. So you can sometimes find out some of those through different organizations and lists. But yeah, if you generally someone board certified, in theory, should at least have a, you know, a decent knowledge of that, no matter what the sleep condition is.
I'd say too, I think it's a plus, you know, whenever possible, and I'm lucky to have this, that my sleep doctor is a pulmonologist, but he is in the same larger practice as my PCP and my other specialists. So they can easily message back and forth to rule some things out. I just recently went through that. So whenever possible, having everybody in that same medical hub is going to be the gold standard.
It can be tough when I just had my sleep doctor leave kind of practice. And so it was tough to then figure out, well, then who do I want to go see? And even though I'm kind of on stable treatment and everything, trying to get all of it transitioned over and make sure that everything stayed, I didn't like, you know, miss any medication. Everything is still a hurdle. So there's just so many hurdles. And I guess I was the new person I chose. I was really encouraged to hear that they were attending sleep meetings. That really helped me, because I think if they were going to things like APSS, the leading sleep meetings, or attending like AASM's trends meeting, that made me feel that they were kind of keeping up with things, which I guess everyone should in the sleep field, but I don't think that's always true necessarily. If sleep isn't their primary focus, they might be less likely to go to something like the big APSS sleep meeting. So,
you know, it can be hard sometimes. I think it's great, Kristen, like working with the primary physician and sleep doctor in good communication is excellent. Sometimes what I've seen that people get frustrated by is they're diagnosed maybe on a really good treatment plan with their sleep doctor. Some reason they can't get medication from them, and then they try to go to the primary care doctor. And some of the ways we use some of these medications in certain sleep conditions can be very different than what they're trained in. So it can be frustrating. For example, if you're stable on a good regimen for narcolepsy and you go to the primary care for whatever reason and try to get refills, if there's not good communication between the sleep provider and that primary care provider might not understand, you know, why certain medications are being used, may have, you know, not be as comfortable refilling them. So it can sometimes be problematic. So that communication is really excellent between primary care and the specialist, something we need a lot more of, I think.
Okay. How to advocate for yourself. So Lauren, I feel like some of this speaks to your experience. You want to share a little bit about being persistent and what we mean by transactional?
Yeah. You know, I've kind of alluded to, it took me a year and a half to get diagnosed once, even after I got referred for a sleep study. And it really just took me being persistent and continuing to believe in myself, and when I needed to, like, reach out for validation and support from others to just keep trying. And I did get discouraged at times and felt hopeless and all of that, but it was just a matter of really having that faith in myself and knowing that, like, what I was experiencing is unfortunately kind of par for the course for sleep disorders. And I feel lucky that I had that awareness going into it, because that was able to help me kind of temper some of my emotions around it. I was able to just kind of reassure myself, like, okay, everybody goes through this when they're going through this, and very fortunate to have the community that I do. And then just about this point about transactional relationships, I want people to like me and I want my doctor to understand me as a person. And I think that's common. I think we all are in a, you know, and we're in that situation in a doctor's office, it's vulnerable. You know, you're experiencing these really difficult things in your personal life. It's affecting your family, maybe your work, your school, whatever. And so it's kind of raw, and it can feel difficult to be just kind of in this situation where maybe somebody has 15 minutes to spend with you and you feel like they don't get it. But for me, what helped was just to be like, okay, this is a transaction. I need a particular thing from this particular person. And if I get that out of this situation, that was a success. So when I first saw my current sleep doctor, I was like, oh, she doesn't like me. She's brusque, you know, whatever. But I was like, am I getting another sleep study? Yes. Okay, good. Let's go. So that helped a lot for me too, in just not getting discouraged or feeling, you know, like anything was personal. Does anybody else have, Kristen, do you have anything to add about this?
Yeah, well, I actually applaud you that you had the insight to like keep going, because I gave up so many times. There were so many times over 15 years that I really did like internalize what other, you know, providers were saying of like, there's nothing wrong, maybe this is just how you are. I really took that on. So definitely the persistence is key, is huge, because I sort of waited for these like really long bands of time where I was excessively sleepy, like for months, to bring it back up again, just because I hadn't really gotten anywhere in the past. But no matter how long it took, you know, I was able to advocate for myself and keeping track of things, you know, being able to actually say, well, 10 years ago, I was also going through this, and here's some data to show it, I think goes a really, really long way.
Yeah. Asking for clarification, I wish I would have done that a little bit more. I think it's just every second is so important. And I, looking back now, like my original doctor, once I was diagnosed, when he was describing different treatments, I actually really misunderstood him. When he said, oh, if you, it was with antidepressants and cataplexy. And I remember he said that if you go off of the antidepressant for cataplexy, then your cataplexy will come back worse than it ever was before. And I thought he meant forever, like that was like my cataplexy was going to like just, and then I was like, oh my God, I can't have that. That's not possible. And I had no idea that he meant like in the short term, that it would come back worse. And it was really influential in my decision to go on a different treatment. I'm perfectly okay with the fact that I went on a different treatment now, but now I actually, it's funny, just look back and realize I actually really misunderstood what he meant there. And so, I just think if you are confused by anything, like there's a lot of information coming really quickly. And I remember he had written a little diagram for me with some of the different options, and that was helpful for me to then go back to my family and discuss, you know, share about the options, I guess. So, and I think, you know, I don't know if everyone really keeps track of those appointment summaries. Like, I don't know how much we really know that they're there, but they should have, you know, notes from your appointment, and that you can go in and access them and make sure that they're correct too, and that they match your memory of the appointments. Anyone else have things to add?
And taking notes right when you get out of the appointment too, because you think that you are going to remember it all and you just don't, like this is a fact. So that's always helpful.
So true. It does seem in the moment, you're like, oh yeah, I'm definitely going to remember all these big words. And then later you're like, what?
I think also, you know, and I think this kind of goes from a lot of different medical situations, following up to make sure that what was meant to happen actually happened. Because, you know, like Kristen was saying earlier, everybody's, you know, so busy and things can fall through the cracks or get miscommunicated. And, you know, for me, this is further along in the journey. And it's a whole nother broadcast talking about getting a sleep study and getting treatment. But just as an example, and this also speaks to the point about asking for time and help, my doctor had, you know, wanted me to pick out what kind of CPAP mask I wanted before she would prescribe it. And I wasted a week freaking out, thinking that I was going to have to know what kind of CPAP mask I wanted before. And so I called the medical supply company. And they were just like, oh, she can just write patient preference. And that way I can go in and I can look at all of the different masks and touch and feel them and try, you know, and they can walk me through all the different options. And then there was some back and forth where the prescription was supposed to get called in, but it didn't get completely called in. So they had to call the doctor back. And I'm the middle person between all of these different communications. And so just having to, it's exhausting, and we're already exhausted, but just keeping up with everything and knowing where you are in the process and what the next step is, and following up and making those phone calls and just continuing to persist in getting what you need for yourself and not caring if you're annoying people.
A really good point. Like you said, like you want to be liked, but actually I think it, you know, then you kind of do have to be persistent. I do remember Stacey Edwards, a really wonderful sleep apnea advocate too, that she also said it's okay to take breaks if you need a break from the process, knowing that you can go back to it, because it is so exhausting and so can be so disheartening that, you know, giving yourself permission to also take a break from these processes and then go back to it when you can, it's important to know too.
Absolutely. And, you know, Kristen, when I felt like there were times when I just couldn't continue either, and I did stop. And I think I probably would have given up entirely, or maybe not entirely, but I don't think I would have a diagnosis now if it wasn't for the community, the Project Sleep community, and the support of this community. And I want everybody to have that. And I want everybody to know that there are resources available and that there's a community here and there's social support. And unfortunately, so many people go through this completely alone. And I think just having other people to connect with helped me have the energy and the persistence to continue.
Important to know about the different patient organizations, as we've been talking about in a few different capacities. All of these organizations have really wonderful resources. As Josh was mentioning, some even have provider directories for specific conditions like RLS or hypersomnia. And yeah, the really different offerings at each one. So it's important to know that they exist. Oh, and our helpline, of course. So we have now the Sleep Helpline as another resource that we hope that we can help validate people who are having issues about your sleep. You can call this number or email us at any time. And our wonderful Sleep Helpline manager, Heather, will get back to you with more resources that, you know, that's a really wonderful resource that can provide personalized support. So she can help work through your situation with you and bounce ideas off each other and, you know, follow up with you to make sure that you're getting the support you need. So we're really proud to have that as a new program. Well, thank you guys so much for joining us today. This is such an important conversation, and we hope that we can help more people get from a primary care doctor to a sleep specialist. And, you know, I just think that if I had like one key thing to, you know, remind people is that maybe we think when we go to a primary care doctor is that they're the expert. If we can empower you with a little bit more knowledge, is to remember that you are also the expert of your situation and that the primary care doctor might not be necessarily a sleep expert. So it might not be always asking your primary care doctor what to do, but suggesting that maybe it could be a sleep disorder and that you'd like to be evaluated by a sleep specialist. There's no harm in being evaluated. And also maybe you don't have a sleep disorder, like that's okay too. So that would be just my biggest point, is to just try to get to a sleep specialist to get a consultation. Does anyone else have any last points before we end?
I would agree with you there. You know, I think 100%. Wide range of training. Everyone, you know, hopefully is trying to do their best with what they have, but not everyone's equipped to, you know, to diagnose and manage. So, you know, make sure to stay persistent and have good communication. And I think suggesting is always, you know, a good way to approach things if you're having issues there. So great, great topic there. And thank you, Julie, for organizing this.
And I just want to reiterate that support is here. And if you're going through something like this, you're not alone, and just reach out.
Yeah. And that's what I didn't know about until I entered my, you know, sleep apnea era. But yeah, there's an incredible community of people online that I've been able to connect with through Project Sleep and otherwise that really have so many resources and are so kind and willing to help. So feel free to reach out to any of us.
All right. Well, thank you guys. And thank you everyone for tuning in. We will follow up. We'll have a toolkit from this eventually. Thanks, guys.
The Project Sleep Podcast is produced by Carver Sound Productions. For more information on podcast production services, visit carversoundproductions.com.